Anyway, we're in this grotty old workshop in the basement, overlooking the harbour, and this was also where Lawrence Hargrave, back in the day, used to design his aeroplanes.
Really?
He was on the...
Oh, everyone had harbourside workshop facilities.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Not an Audio File, the podcast. Season 2, Episode 1. Today, Kim Ryrie is on the program. We question him about all sorts of things, including, of course, the fact that he was the co-founder of the world's first sampling synthesizer, but also about DEX. This episode of Not an Audio File is sponsored by StereoNet. Are you looking for your tribe? Visit StereoNet.com today to join one of the world's largest online communities for hi-fi, home cinema, headphones, and much more. Read the latest news and product reviews or check out the classifieds for the largest range of gear on sale. Membership is absolutely free, so visit StereoNet.com and join up today. Thank you for your time, Kim. It's an absolute pleasure to be here. I've had a quick tour of the facility with Brad and yourself showing us around just now, and it's very, very impressive. It's impressive for what is being done here in Sydney, I guess, as far as what's being manufactured, but the design is I mean, it's, for my tiny brain, it's astounding. So maybe we wind back. So we're talking about the DEX factory in Sydney, DEQX, which is a preamp, DAC, streamer device with, most importantly, incredibly high-quality DSP built in. And I want you to tell us all about that. But I want to wind back briefly and have you bore us for 4.5 minutes with your backstory, which is long. Everyone knows about the Fairlight. It wasn't just you that were involved with it, but just...
You mean my first failed attempt at trying to make a loudspeaker happen?
Oh,
he's dangled the carrot.
Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, that goes back a long time.
Speakers were invented then, were they?
Or speakers were just coming out.
Just coming out.
They just worked out that if you put a coil of wire and a magnet and glue a bit of paper to it, it'll make a noise.
It'll make a noise.
Yeah. So that's sort of my vintage, really.
So I have no idea how old you
so
are.
So I've
it
seen
doesn't
the
matter.
Entire...
But was this 60s or
70s? Don't ask. this was 60s, actually.
Yeah, okay, right.
But no, it really all started happening in the 70s, early 70s.
Okay.
I was always interested as a kid in electronics and audio, and I tried to make passive speakers in the 60s and I failed miserably to make a passive speaker sound any good, so I gave that up straight away.
Yes.
So if at first you don't succeed, give up.
Never try again. What was that Homer Simpson thing where he opens the cupboard and there's a jiu-jitsu suit, a guitar and something else hard to learn, a unicycle perhaps, shoved in a cupboard. And Bart puts his... What the hell? I don't even remember what Bart's trying to learn. Geez, I wish I didn't bring that up now, that reference. But it's a classic Simpsons scene where Homer says exactly that.
Oh, yeah.
And he opens the cupboard full of failed attempts. But,
right, a whole lot of them.
And there's just the standard things that people can't learn in 5 minutes. Yeah. One of them is passive loudspeaker design. So,
that's right. So. And I loved audio, so it was an obvious thing to try to do, make a passive speaker, and, you know, you could buy the bits and do all that. But I, my father had a magazine company called Modern Magazines. We did Modern Motor, Rugby League Week, Revs Motorcycle News,
Revs.
Australian Cricket.
Jeez, I had a pile of Revs.
I've got all those magazines.
Yeah, and exactly.
And still, I have.
Yeah.
And I was an avid reader of Electronics Australia, you know, back in the day. And I liked doing all their DIY projects and stuff. But I showed the magazine to my father and said, listen, why don't we do an electronics magazine? And I think he probably wanted me to, you know, carry on the family tradition and, you know, end up being in the magazine business.
Yeah.
And so he said, yeah, okay. Well, he first thing was he saw all the ads in Australian
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Electronics Australia thought, yeah, okay, turned. Let's do that. So yeah.
just like that.
So it's, we started.
So looking spinner. Through the magazine, there's dollar signs running around.
Yeah, so well, so we found an editor, an English guy called Colin Rivers, who mm-hmm. was fantastic. He could spell and write a sentence, which I couldn't do. Awesome.
Yes, yeah.
And so we started Electronics Today. It was called in 1971, and I was working in the DIY projects lab. Mm. So there was a few of us there trying to come up with projects for people to build at home. And so we made little amplifier modules, 100 watt amplifier modules and stuff like that. And you had a month to do it. You had a month to think of what you were going to do the next issue.
Mm-hmm.
You had to design the product. 1 month.
Okay, so
typically we'd have 2 or 3 projects a month, right?
Yeah. So, well, my memory of those magazines is exactly that, is that there was probably 2 or 3 kits a month.
Yeah.
So I never really thought about it as a kid, I guess, but yeah, you've got these. They've got to be done every month.
Every month.
There's no back catalogue of kits to fall back on.
Yeah. That's right. And especially back in those days, there was virtually nothing happening.
Yeah.
So the guy that did most of the designs, a guy called Barry Wilkinson, a mm-hmm. brilliant designer, and he was just able to churn this stuff out, and I'd help or suggest projects do all that.
Well, and, for clarity, you'd suggest them, and he
and everyone else would do all the hard work. That's the story of my life, really.
Well, it's
a superpower.
It's a
superpower.
Yeah, it's. I'm great at taking credit for other people's work, and that's also the story of Fairlight. But that's another.
I think so. I think there's a bit of magic from you.
That's another story. But so, the Moog synthesizer had just come out, and everyone knew about it.
So this is early 70s.
This was like 73? 60s, I think.
Oh, that is it. That,
oh, hang on. Was it? I can't remember, but it was switched on by Walter Carlos, who became Wendy Carlos. And I was just couldn't believe it. I just thought, this is unbelievable. Everyone's got to have one of these. And this is the future of everything.
Mm.
And so immediately I conned everyone at the magazine. Remember, I was the
You had a bit of sway. Yes, yeah.
And I said, listen, why don't we do a DIY synthesizer project so that everyone can build their own Moog synthesizer, right?
Which sounds...
And everyone's going, oh, my God.
Serious project.
I love the way you said conned. In fact,
So anyway, we found a young guy who had just finished electrical engineering, because we were all flat out doing other projects, and Trevor Marshall, I think it was. And so we worked with Trevor to come up with what we thought would be a good, manageable thing. Anyway, long story short, took 10 months to publish this. So one month we'd do a voltage-controlled oscillator.
Yeah, okay.
Next month we'd do a voltage-controlled amplifier. Yeah. Next one we did a transient generator and keyboard controller.
So we keep people coming back
for
more.
Yeah, so this went on forever.
Yeah.
And at the end of it, we had a thing called the ETI, because by now Electronics Today had become Electronics Today International, because we'd opened a French edition and a UK edition.
Okay.
And so we had this being... So we had... Actually, there were apparently thousands of these built around the world.
Well, yeah, okay.
Because part suppliers like JCAR, for example, would kit the whole thing. As little bits, you know. Yeah. Here's the oscillator kit, and so it wasn't very expensive. So people would do this.
Yeah.
And but by the time we got to the end of it, and I'd used it in some projects. Some friends of mine were making records and stuff, and I'd go and do the synthesizer. And I just got really frustrated that it couldn't do natural sounds. No matter what I did, I couldn't get a violin sound or a piano sound or whatever.
Right.
Which I assumed is what you wanted a synthesizer to do, you know, as well as synthetic sounds.
Like space sounds,
And but then the microprocessor had just come out, the Motorola 6800.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, oh, these look amazing. You know, imagine if we incorporated these into a new synthesizer design. And so by now I'd left ETI because I wanted to do this digital synthesizer. So to do that, I contacted a schoolmate of mine, Peter Vogel, said, what are you doing? He said, not much. What are you doing? I said, not much, but I want to build, or do you want to build the world's greatest synthesizer, because we can, we know how to make these analog things. All we need to do is add, you know, these microprocessor things, and it'll all be fabulous. And the way, the real problem
it'll
with...
It'll all be fabulous. So what was Peter's...
It's very Trumpian, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to build the best synthesizer in the world.
Well, Trump would use a harder sounding word, like tremendous.
But
tremendous.
So what's Peter's skills similar to yours? Or
Peter and I at school used to make things at school together.
Okay.
Peter was a great electronics designer. Mm-hmm. He made a thing called MERV, which was a little robot as a school project.
Oh,
and
wow,
it'd wheel itself around and it'd crash into things and then back off. And,
and this was in what year was Peter doing?
Well, this would have been late 60s.
Oh, wow. You know, okay.
Mid 60s, maybe.
That's kind of impressive in itself, really. You know,
Peter was really good. And so we had a great time at Cranbrook. We never learnt much, but
maybe you did.
Well, it doesn't sound like you needed to.
Well, once we used to be involved in the drama society there because Cranbrook would put on these plays, right. And they were very proud of them, typically Gilbert and Sullivan and stuff. But the old aircraft resistance dimmers that we were using on the stage were getting very old. And Peter and I thought, why don't we make some solid-state dimmers and we could remote control them and everything? And we couldn't work out how to convince the headmaster to budget this thing. Mm. And we figured out it had cost at least $300 to make a sort of 20-channel dimmer.
Yeah. Which in the late 60s.
Which seems like a bargain in some ways. So, but then it was all the money in the world, I guess.
So we poured some iron filings down into the resistance dimmers. To give a demonstration that it was time that they got replaced.
These bastards.
And so as you move the dimmers, the sparks fly out of everywhere. And so, oh, yes, we better do this.
Did you have an extinguisher handy at the time or something? Or we just...
No, not really. We figured it wasn't going to burn up. So we got the budget, you know, to buy it. We made our own dimmers. We weren't allowed to install them to the 240 volts, so we had to get a real electrician to do that. But they all worked brilliantly.
Okay.
So for the opening ceremony, we had it all installed, and we had a remote console that we took down into the auditorium, and there was a little switch on it, which switched on this giant three-phase breaker up in the lighting gallery.
Mm-hmm.
But we connected there a little pot of potassium nitrate and magnesium powder, which is what in the old days you used to use that on stage when the witch appeared.
Yes,
you know?
yes.
And
for a little small bit of pyrotechnics.
So we'd organise that when the senior master turned the switch on to initiate our new thing, the lighting gallery went up in smoke. Which it did.
just smoke though, right? No flame.
Just smoke. Oh, just a bright light because magnesium powder, potassium nitrate. So it's
a flash.
So a bright flash and then quite a bit of stinky
smoke.
So
anyway, the poor director of the play was suicidal because the dress rehearsal was in 2 days' time. So anyway, that was what the sort of thing Peter and I did at school. So
that sounds like a lot of
hijinks, old-fashioned hijinks.
Yeah.
Although creating something that worked—that's the other thing.
So
the dimmers worked brilliantly.
The dimmers worked fine. So we left school. So it was actually several years before I called Peter to say, "Let's start. Yeah. Let's do this." And I sort of talked him into it. And at the time, he was doing video. Product because colour had just started in Australia, and he was making a little colourizer thing.
Oh. Yep,
and
colourizer.
Where you just feed in a video signal, and you could, depending on the luminance level, you could mix your own RGB colour. So you could do six bands of colour based on
the from monochrome.
Yeah, over monochrome.
Over monochrome.
Yeah.
And it was really just a special effects,
just for effects,
box,
yeah,
and it was
yeah.
just fun.
Yes, you couldn't add colour to a black and white TV show, unfortunately. No,
unless
yeah. well, you could.
Arnie Jack, do you remember Arnie Jack? The comedy show.
Well, I remember
Arnie
the
Jack.
Show. Yes.
Well, I was in the Arnie Jack band. Gloria Donahue. And I'll tell you the story. I'll tell you the story in a second, Rory.
Well, just before I go on, you've got to remember that. Did you remember the show where the colour was coming up from the rule?
Oh, that's right.
And it's in black and white. Sorry to be so rude, Kim, but I watched it the other day on YouTube. And there's Arnie Jack and Maria Donahue.
Yeah, Graham.
And
Gary McDonald.
And they're in black and white, but they see it coming up Coromel, Thirroul, and it's coming all the way up to Wollongong where they were, and keep going. And then it sort of goes half, they're getting drowned in
colour.
I was going to bring up the Arnie Jack band because it was my first experience with speakers, which is important to this story.
Jermaine, in fact.
Yeah. In fact, we might just jump to it because we'll be here all day.
Fascinated about the Arnie Jack show that you were involved with it in some way.
Yeah, well, actually, no. I'll,
that's a bit of history.
I'll just go back to where we were with Starting Fairlight. So we had no money. Peter and I were used to doing things with no money, so it's why we didn't even think of that when he said, do you want to do the new thing? We had my grandmother had a basement free to use.
Yes, yes.
On the waterfront of Point Piper.
Quite a nice place next door to have a workshop.
Yeah, her name was Altona. She and her two sisters owned the three houses in a row, one of which is Altona, which recently sold for like $50 million or something.
No doubt.
So anyway, we're in this grotty old workshop in the basement overlooking the harbour, and this was also where Lawrence Hargrave, back in the day, used to design his aeroplanes.
Really? Everyone had Harbourside workshop facilities.
Exactly. And my grandmother used to say, this place will never be worth anything. And she literally believed it, because when the Japs next come through the harbour in their submarines, it's the first place that gets shot at.
Oh, wow. And it literally was a different time.
It was a different time. So she believed that. So anyway, we started Fairlight in that basement.
Okay.
Fairlight was named after the hydrofoil that kept driving past the thing, and Peter and I were arguing about what to call the company, whether it was going to be Rye Vog. Peter said, why don't we call it Fairlight?
So Fairlight was the name of one of the ferries.
Yeah.
And would have been one of the old school ones, of course.
It was the hydrofoil.
Oh, it was the hydrofoil.
Yeah.
Advanced. They were cool. That's very 70s, isn't it?
And Peter ended up buying the hydrofoil when it just gets better and better. Put it out to pasture, you see, and
of course, it
was going to cost $1 million a month just to put somewhere, and he ended up getting rid of it. But we did get the life saving life raft off it with Fairlight's name on it, so that was fun. So
okay. Amazing.
Well, that's
Where was I? So we started Fairlight. I'm not going to go into Fairlight, sorry, because it's
Rye
Vog.
Rye Vogel. Yeah, Fairlight.
Or Vogel Rye.
Got a certain charm versus Rye Vog.
Definitely. I wasn't even sure I liked Fairlight. I thought, that's a bit oomy goomy, isn't it? And
oomy goomy.
So we ended up just stuck. Right? It was a good name.
It is a good name. It's a great name.
And that's a whole other story. I won't go into that.
Because
that went on for years. But
it was disruptive, wasn't it? Was it not disruptive?
Yeah, because we ended up coming out with the first ever sampling keyboard.
Mm.
The first one that could literally play any sound.
Yes.
First piano.
Violins.
We were selling them for $25,000. Couldn't make enough of them by 1980.
Yeah, just to clarify the guts of the Fairlight story, well, I think people certainly in the music industry know what it was, but I don't think anyone knows it was $25,000 US.
It was $25,000 US.
So the price of a house,
people literally were deciding whether to buy a unit in the UK or to buy a Fairlight.
Yes.
And and they bought the Fairlight.
Yeah.
And we sold, a lot. There's a lot of them out there.
Yeah.
And
when you say a lot, I think I heard
when I say a lot, I mean it's not thousands, but it's
no. I think I heard up to close to 1,000 once in a. But no, that doesn't mean it was factual.
No,
a few hundred, though, right?
It was several hundred. It was several probably hundred, yeah. three and a half.
I suppose it's more like importantly,
it's quite a lot.
Who purchased them?
Well, okay. So initially, remember I mentioned next door to my sister, my grandmother's house was a place where Bruce Jackson lived.
Well, mentioned that they were building aeroplanes next door, but
no, they were building aeroplanes in where our workshop was, but next door was an even ritzier building.
Hang on, let's just stop for a second.
He's scaring me.
This is interesting. So where you were going to do the Fairlight project?
Yes, yeah. Where we started.
That is where Mr. Hargroves. The yes. same building.
That's the same workshop. Same workshop. It was a basement of this.
That's amazing Australian manufacturing and design history that you've got.
Yeah. Absolutely,
Mr. Hargroves, and then you take the space over.
It was where my grandmother's husband had his workshop,
right,
and he died many years earlier.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So it was full of all that sort of junk, which we cleared out.
Okay.
And it was a fairly big space, and it was, for instance, the sort of thing we were working on there was a touch-sensitive keyboard. We hadn't worked out how to make the microprocessor work, so someone, when they heard about us doing it, said, "Oh, you should meet this guy called Tony Furse, because he knows all about microprocessors, and in fact." He was the consultant for Motorola in Australia. And so we met Tony, and unbelievably, Tony had already designed the first part of a digital synthesizer using the Motorola microprocessor. So he couldn't finish it. He had to get on with his own business.
Yeah, okay.
He got a grant to get this thing going for the Canberra School of Music to show them how you could add harmonics together to create complex waveforms, and there was a light pen, and you could move faders up and down on the screen to mix harmonics, and it was already doing that. It was everything was hand wired.
So some of that kind of got melded in with your.
Well, what happened was I was amazed that he'd done all this. He'd already done a parallel processor architecture, because in those days, an 8-bit processor like the Motorola 6800, very limited, only ran at 1 megahertz. Tony had come up with a way of getting two of them to run out of sync with each other, with common memory in between. So instead of having to interrupt the processor to do anything, which in those days, you know, you could go out and make a cup of tea when you interrupted a processor, you could have an I/O processor, which is dealing with all your input output, such as playing keys on a keyboard.
Yes, yeah.
And the other processor could be doing more complex stuff. And the way Tony had organized it is that the memory ran at 2 megs, and each processor was running at 1 meg, but out of phase, right? So you could put data from one processor in a memory, the other processor would take it out in the next cycle. So this became, according to Motorola, this was the first implementation in the world of parallel processing using microprocessors.
Okay.
So they were, and that was Tony doing that, not us.
No.
But we hit the ground running, because Tony wanted to offload his requirements to deliver this thing to the Canberra School of Music.
Yeah, okay.
And he said, look, if you take it over, you can do what you like with it, but you've got to deliver something to this mob, right? Sooner or later. Because I've got a grant.
And because he got the grant.
He got a grant to get it started. Yeah. Anyway, they were in this box, which was probably, you know, a metre and a half long by half a metre deep and high. And there were 20 circuit boards in it, about 8 inches by 8-inch circuit boards. Every board was different.
Yes.
Did a different function, but it did it for 8 channels, 8 notes, effectively.
Yeah, okay.
You could play 8 polyphony on the keyboard. So it sounded horrible. It couldn't do sampling. It wasn't designed that.
No.
But it was the core of what we wanted, because it was manipulating waveform memory. So the way it worked was, you would wind up these faders, you could mix harmonics, you have this much first harmonic, this much second harmonic, this much third. It sounded as boring as you can imagine, really sterile. But it was educational, which was what the Canberra School of Music wanted.
Right.
And but I thought, well, that's all right, but we'll have to just work out how to make it sound good.
Right.
So we took it over, and I think Tony was, we worked out a sort of little royalty deal with Tony, and then we spent the next probably year designing all those boards onto actual circuit boards, printed circuit boards. We then realised
all those boards that were in the box that he gave you was all on like Vero board or something, or, well, or hand etched.
It was literally on. It wasn't wire wrapped. It was hand soldered using Teflon coated wires. There were thousands of wires on each board. It was an app which Tony had done prototype.
Yeah.
And so we took this over, and Peter soon worked out how to. We said, look, the main thing that happened was that 16K bit memory chip came out.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, Peter, look at this. This is a... Oh, let me explain. Tony's machine only had 4K of 8-bit memory, and that was the waveform. Each waveform was only 256 bytes long, which meant we could have up to the 64th harmonic, but in fact we were only doing up to 32 harmonics. And when you play, and you could play that on the keyboard, so you could create this one cycle of a waveform that had whatever content of harmonics you want. But bear in mind, these are harmonics, not inharmonics, and natural sounds include a lot of inharmonics. They're not perfectly mathematically related to the fundamental,
right?
So, especially in a transient sense, so it still didn't sound even remotely natural.
Yeah.
And but we had a way of manipulating sound in waveform memory. We had a way of changing the pitch. Mm. We could sustain it, things like that. We could vary its attack and decay, stuff like that.
Okay.
So and. Oh, the other thing I didn't mention is this was before floppy disks, let alone hard disks. So to boot up the processor, you used punched paper tape
on a
teletype, and there was a reel of tape about a foot in diameter that took an hour to boot because the tape would unravel, go through the thing. So if you trod on it, because it came from the floor, you'd have to start again. You'd have to glue the tape back together and start again.
Jesus.
So this was booting the processor. I thought
floppies were bad. Jeez, all right.
And, well, thank God, you know, the floppy then came out very soon after this. So pretty quickly we were able to implement the floppy disk. It was only like 128K per disk.
This is the original floppy. The original floppy was the big one.
8-inch floppy, 128K bytes per disk.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And we had 4K of waveform memory in this machine. 4K bytes. We're not even talking about 16-bit audio.
We're
talking about 8-bit audio.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? 8-bit audio means guaranteed 1% distortion out of the box, and that's assuming you're using all 8 bits worth of level.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, anyway, long story short, we redesigned. The 16K memory chip came out. I said to Peter, listen, the 16K memory chip, why don't we just have one board that does one channel with 16K of memory, and Peter, all these functions at all these different boards, that we can put all that on one board, and to do 8 channels, we just need 8 boards, right? 8 of the same boards. Then you had extra boards, which had the dual processor board, you had the memory board, you had the floppy disk controller board, you had the light pen board. This is before mouses had been invented, we're talking. This is Apple.
Well, this is, I mean, for the listeners, this,
it's great to have that.
This is a long time ago.
We're talking 75.
Yeah. So, is this when you were doing that part of it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. 75,
76.
This is, sort of,
And Apple came out in 77.
Prehistoric times, yeah.
And And we had an operating system that was used for medical and industrial stuff. Mm-hmm. And we were able to, I don't know how we, I'm trying to think how we negotiated this, but somehow I managed to get the source code for this operating system. And it was a real-time, very robust, nothing like Windows. It was very limited, mm-hmm. but it was...
I'm guessing that the guy who wrote the source code lived three doors up.
No, it was an overseas thing.
Well, there was a lot of people in that street, Brad. Stop chuckling.
No, I agree with you.
They weren't building aeroplanes. They were inventing...
That's true. So we managed to get that... what happened then? So we got that working. So effectively, we had the first prototype unit by 79. So we started.
So you did spend some years on it.
It took 4 years to get.
Wow.
That.
Okay.
Right, and in the meantime, we'd managed to get some family money together to help us. Yep, we moved out of the basement. We moved to Rushcutters Bay.
Yeah. Okay.
And we started to be introduced to people that knew what they were doing.
Because they could anyone smell that, could, that you were doing something pretty cutting edge.
We were really lucky to run into some very, very smart people early on.
Yep.
People like Michael Carlos, for instance, mm-hmm. Who was the musical director of Jesus Christ Superstar, the first version of it. Yep. He came out to Australia with a band called Tully. The government didn't want to let Tully into the country to do Hair. They were the band for Hair when that came out.
Because
they had drug convictions, meaning dope convictions.
Heavy.
Right?
Heavy.
So, they're the heavy stuff.
Heavy,
and
man.
So anyway, they came here. So Michael is just one of those geniuses, right? He was a musical. He was a composer. He was, you know, he's like a polymath, Michael. You know, so he came to us one day and said, oh... We were introduced to him. We showed him the first sampling bit of hardware.
Yeah.
Took it to his house. He had a dog that you could say speak, and the dog would go woof. You know. So I said, Michael, get your dog to speak. Right. So we got the mic out.
Yes.
Got the dog sample, which was a bark.
Yeah.
And that was the first ever
sample. Wow.
Okay. On the Fairlight, in the Fairlight Sound
that's
Library.
That's powerful, isn't it? Because you've got his master's voice, his the dog looking up at the
that's true,
gramophone.
It was an actual dog.
Yeah.
And bearing in mind, we only had 16K of memory, but we had variable sample rate from up to 200K. The way we controlled pitch was simply we varied the clock speed of the DAC. But we could go down to like... we could probably go down to about 2K sample rate for a bass note, which meant you'd have all this aliasing noise going on. So we had a tracking filter. So we had a low-pass filter that tracked just, you know, at half of the sample rate to get rid of the aliasing noise. So this was like, talk about seat-of-the-pants stuff. And but that's how it worked. And
a time
and
when
so
storage
could,
was at a premium.
That's right.
Yeah,
amazing.
So, and that's how all the Fairlights that were selling for $25,000 had 8-bit audio, but they had another 8 bits of level control. So it was a sort of pseudo 16-bit. So that we always tried
but
to.
But it kind of sounded pretty good, though.
It sounded good.
Yeah.
Everyone loved the sound.
Yeah,
of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was a series one, series two. And series three went to 16 bits, much longer memory.
So when did
hard
the,
disk recording, the whole catastrophe?
The crazy success was from the start.
From
or
the
was
start,
from
it was
the
virtually
start.
From the start. So what I was just going to say. So next door to the house at Point Pie was a guy called Bruce Jackson.
That's
lived
what we were
there.
Up to. Yes, yeah.
And Bruce and I were friends. He started a company in Australia called Jans, which was Jackson and Story. That's
okay.
where the
is that
J-A-N-S
where that comes from?
Yes.
Okay. Well, certainly, I think we're
so
Australian listeners are familiar with Jans.
Yeah, yeah. And so Bruce designed mixing consoles and all this. He was a great electronics designer.
Yep.
And he was particularly into outdoor PA stuff.
Indeed.
Which was what Jans got into.
Yes. Yep.
And when Clare Brothers, who was like the American version of Jans, you know, 20 times bigger, doing all the big bands and stuff outdoors. Bruce met with, I think it was Ron Clare, I think his name was, and he soon realised what a genius Bruce was and offered him a job to go and work at Clare. And so Bruce moved to America.
Okay.
And he offered to build them a mobile console because they were doing these huge outdoor consoles.
Yeah, yeah.
People like Bruce Springsteen,
yeah.
Elvis.
Yeah.
And so one day Elvis's sound guy was Crook, and Bruce was asked to do his outdoor concert.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And he told Elvis he wasn't sounding too good. It was really not sounding great.
Thank you very much.
And no one had ever told Elvis that before, I don't think.
No one had told Elvis anything negative, perhaps.
So what happened? Long story short, Bruce became the only person Elvis would let mix for him after that. Elvis bought Bruce an aeroplane for his birthday.
Some of the nicest presents you can get.
Yeah, yeah. And
aircraft?
I know, it was a little thing.
Cessna 172?
Not a 707.
No. It was just a little thing. So when we had the prototype, I rang up Bruce and said, Bruce, we've got this thing and it can play any sound. And by the way, we also had sequencing now. You could play stuff and it would record what you played.
Yeah, so this is Bruce's introducing Elvis's team or Elvis?
Well, not so much Elvis because Elvis didn't want to...
No.
Yep, sampler, but of course Bruce knew everyone in Los Angeles, so he said, "Oh well, we'll bring it." No, we said, "Bruce, we've got this thing, and it can play any sound. It can play itself." He said, "Well, you know, what are you talking about?" And I said, "Well, it can play anything." And he sort of didn't believe it actually, and I said, "Well, look, Peter will come over with it and show you." And if you know anyone that can afford $25,000, because that's what we think we've got to sell them for.
By the way.
You know, and he said, okay, we'll bring it over. So Peter took it over.
Yeah.
And Bruce first introduced him to Geordie Hormel. Now, Geordie Hormel, you know Spam? As in pig meat?
Monty Python.
Spam.
It's pig meat. It's what you know, everyone has in their bomb shelters back in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
So... Spam was made by Hormel Meats, and Hormel Meats was sort of half of Minnesota.
Yeah, okay.
And Geordie was one of the two heirs to Hormel Meats. He wasn't allowed to go to the factory, but he used to get a lot of money every month for being an heir.
To stay away.
because Geordie was a musician.
And
he used to write music for the I Love Lucy show.
Desilu Productions.
And then... Geordie started the biggest recording studio in Los Angeles called Village Recorder, which at the time...
Heard the name, yes.
Fleetwood Mac were recording the Tusk album at the Village Recorder. So the first thing Bruce did was take... He knew Geordie, so he's... Geordie, you should see this thing. It plays any sound. And took it to Village Recorder, and Geordie said, well, show it to these guys. So they just immediately pulled out their checkbook.
As in what? Fleetwood Mac did?
Fleetwood Mac.
Okay.
$25,000, sign here, no questions asked, no discussion about price. Geordie said, now we'll go and see Stevie, i.e. Wonder.
Yes, yes.
And Stevie then, Wonder.
Who's in the next room or at the next studio?
No, he was down the road. We're talking about Los Angeles. Yeah. This was in East LA.
Yeah.
Where he has his studio, and so same thing. Stevie pulled out his checkbook, put his thumbprint on it, $25,000, no discussion about price. But while the demo was happening in Stevie's studio, one of his engineers said, "Oh, Peter's got to hear about this." He's talking about Peter Gabriel in London. So he rings up Peter from the studio.
Yeah.
Says, "Peter, you should see this thing. It can play any sound and it can, and it can do itself." And he said, "Oh, well, how can I get to hear one?" And so once Peter got back to Sydney, he ended up then going to London to see Peter Gabriel. So Peter Gabriel...
got his checkbook out.
Yeah, but Peter's nephew, a guy called Stephen Payne, convinced Peter to fund starting the distribution company for the UK.
Oh, okay.
To sell these things.
Yeah, right.
Because, of course, I just... told anyone if they wanted to sell them, they could, you know. Oh, Geordie, meanwhile, had said, "If you give me the exclusive rights to North America, I'll buy every machine you can make." So by then he'd already sold one to Carly Simon, and even on Peter's trip, I think we sold about four on that trip.
And so is that, wow, I guess I'm jumping ahead to the music itself, but so albums of that era, because now we're talking very early 80s, aren't we? Well, we're talking Tusk, which
We're talking absolute beginning of the 80s. This would have been 80.
Yeah, well, Tusk has got to be... Yeah, I would have thought. Well, they worked on it for 2 years or something anyhow, but, yeah, it was probably 79, 80 or something like that, yeah. So the instrument does feature, I guess, on those albums here and there. There must be a long list of credits for the...
Well, yes. Look, over the years, there was especially... Well, it was the 80s where it took off. So... Yeah. So, and of course, being in the UK with Peter behind it, we got introduced to everyone. It was no problem. And so they sold dozens of machines just in London. And that was just the Series 1. And then there, within a couple of years, we brought out the Series 2, and we'd put MIDI into that. We sort of, we virtually invented MIDI because...
On that note, because I think... On that bombshell, we invented MIDI. I'm going to take a 2 second break.
Jeff from Hey Now Hi-Fi sells really good hi-fi that you can't get everywhere, both online and in store. You may be interested or you may not. If so, check out his website. That's heynowhifi.com.au. That's heynowhifi.com.au.
We were talking about Fairlight. We've covered a lot of that story, although we can't cover all of it because it's so... There's so much of it. So, but during that, in the previous segment, we went sideways with Fairlight and how it got introduced to the States and the UK. But you were touching on your days with the Artie Jack Band. So I want to get the backstory on that, because that, I believe, is what led you into active or digital audio. Well, active audio or active loudspeakers.
Yeah.
But just to finish off on Fairlight, which is such an amazing tale, except it's not a tale. It's a real story. It actually happened. Incredible success straight away, which at the time, I mean, the adrenaline rush on that must have been... I mean, you'd spent 4 years in a cave next to the harbour trying to...
Oh, no, that wasn't 4 years. That was... No, no, that was only... Moved. You'd moved that was only about premises. 1 year.
1 year, okay.
And then we moved... to a real office when we managed to raise some money.
Still 4 years of grind.
A lot of work. It was.
So the payoff, though, was amazing, I guess.
Yeah, but it was mainly stress.
well, then you had to build the things, right?
Yeah, I mean, remember we had no income. Well, no, that's not true. We did anything for money.
Yeah, okay.
So we did a sleeping dog car alarm.
Right.
We did... Remington office machines had heard that we were the only manufacturer of a computer in Australia, so they came to us and said, could we build them an office computer?
Okay.
And I said, well, as long as you can do the software, because, you know, we don't know anything about business software. He said, oh yeah, we can do that. Okay. If you give us the hardware. And so we made them, you know, we managed to put together four 8-inch hard floppy drives in a cabinet, and it had a, you know, it ran basically, and they wrote this software. It was pretty bad, but they sold about 100 of those. So it was all helping us with cash flow.
Yeah. Okay,
and that's where we did learn about how to make things reliable, because what happened in that exercise was that they needed a megabyte of storage. So we only could have four floppy drives, and the original drives were only 128 kilobytes, which means four drives means you've only got half a meg. But the double-sided floppy had just come out by a company called Shugart, and we bought some of their first ones because this means we can do the Remington system. Because if we have four of these drives, they'll get their 1 meg of memory, and it'll all be fabulous.
Mm.
So we ordered, and we had an order for 100 systems from things.
Yeah,
so I ordered, 400 drives from Shugart, and what we discovered first of all was that these drives would tend to scrape the oxide off the discs after a while.
After a while, yeah, yeah, great.
Which was a bit embarrassing. And then occasionally the one side, the head on one side of the disc would write through to the other side.
Oh, no.
It didn't happen often, but it happened often enough to make you want to kill yourself.
And then want to kill you.
And then we two things we discovered. One was that IBM made a floppy disk that where the oxide did not scrape off. Solved that problem. But then we informed Shugart that their drives were writing to the other side of the drive, and they said, yes, we know, so we're stopping production.
Oh, crikey.
I said, you can't stop production because I've just accepted an order for 100 machines from Remington. You know Remington? You heard of them? Well, actually, we do know a hand modification we can do to the head that does fix the problem, but it's too expensive for us, so we've stopped making them. I said, listen, we will have to do something legally if you can't sort this out, because we're completely committed and you've accepted our order.
Yep.
So they restarted the line for us.
Okay. And did the mod,
things
obviously
by hand, but within literally only a few months, a Japanese company came out, and I think it was YE Data they were called, and it was a double-sided drive, just beautifully made, no problems, read through, it was even cheaper. Shugart were dying to stop supplying us,
so they
didn't care.
So
we changed over to those. But in the process we just learnt how to make these systems very reliable, because one thing about, you know, the 70s and 80s when we had the Fairlight out, people didn't know that computers had bugs, right?
No,
they were only used to golf ball typewriters that didn't have bugs.
They just everything worked. Everything was kind of analog and worked.
Exactly, everything worked. So when bugs happened, the world ended. You know, it was like, this thing doesn't work.
It worked a minute ago.
Which was why, actually, that's when we bought the source code to the operating system, because there were problems in the operating system that they couldn't fix because they weren't doing with it what we were doing. So we were able to debug the operating system, and that's really ultimately became the downfall of Fairlight, because we got so used to having control of the operating system that everyone refused to move to Windows, which is where ultimately the competition came from. Did you design and
As you move through the 80s and you've got your various iterations, version 1, 2, 3 you mentioned, but there were more.
Yeah, and we were also upgrading the processors in the time.
And at some point you were doing your interface, doing it the way you'd always done it.
Yeah.
Competition machines...
We dropped out. We had to stop. We became uncompetitive in the music business because... It was there just wasn't the resources in Australia to make things as cost effectively as some of the competition was, and we'd already saturated the high end market with hundreds of machines.
Yes.
You just, after a while, you run out of people that can afford crazy money.
Yeah, exactly. There's no home recording guys. Not that there were any home recording guys even then, but by then
we started working on post production.
Yeah, okay.
And we were able to synchronize our sequences with time code from movies.
Well, you did, we finished the previous segment on the bombshell that you invented MIDI. So is that
But we effectively had the structure. We preempted MIDI.
Yes.
With everything that MIDI ended up doing, we'd already done. That's what I meant by that. There was a MIDI organisation.
In essence, you didn't invent MIDI as in the acronym, but the concept and what it did, you were already doing it.
That's right. Just for clarity. But then we moved to post-production because there was a recession at the end of 88. Where everyone stopped buying the expensive keyboards, we had to shut down the original Fairlight company and restart it.
Yeah,
into post-production.
Okay.
And because by then we had the first 8-track hard disk recorder running, so mm-hmm. we could run 8 tracks of audio onto a hard disk. Mm-hmm. And and we also had 16-channel Fairlight. We could do 16 notes at a time.
Yeah,
we had a lot of buffer memory. You could have minutes of a note on one channel. So I'm thinking, well, why don't we make a 24-track hard disk recorder for doing post-production? Because post-production, you don't need all 24 tracks to be playing at once.
No.
You only need about 16, which is what we had.
Yeah.
You only need a continuous 8 tracks, mm-hmm. which is what we had, as long as you had lots of buffer mm-hmm. on the 16. So I did this smoke and mirrors product. And and what happened was you could see the waveform scrolling across the screen, and you could see the actual waveforms. You could edit them, cut and paste, do all that stuff. So we had the first digital audio workstation effectively that could do that.
Yep.
And we just instantly routed to one of 24 output channels depending on what track something was happening on.
Yes.
So you might have atmospheres taking up a stereo track continuously, you might have music taking up stereo mm-hmm. continuously, but everything else was pretty much bits and pieces. And we got away with that, and we were selling those for $100,000 to Hollywood.
Yeah.
They were buying every machine we could make. We had Sony Pictures, Tolio and Glenn, Paramount. They were all buying these things because it was so fast to use compared to what they were used to. And so that was Fairlight number 2 in effect, which was post-production.
Okay. Which no one talks about, but they should.
No one talks about it because it's not music. But it was really the first of those systems. Nowadays, you can go... Fairlight was bought by Blackmagic, who were the video company, Australian company.
Yeah.
Yes. Mel, brilliant company.
Yeah.
So they now own all the Fairlight IP. And you can download Fairlight workstation for free now.
I thought I'd seen that. Yeah. Yes.
And, which was genius.
And then when I saw the name, I'm like, it can't be related to the original.
Well, of course, there's all these options that you pay for.
Yes, yeah.
But it was genius on their part because Fairlight had lost the early market to Avid DigiDesign.
Yes. Yeah.
And and the only way to get the market back was to basically give it away so that people could start using it and
train themselves up on it.
And now you can do thousands of tracks using the Fairlight stuff. It's really, really good. And it's completely integrated with their video editing stuff, which is equally really good. So it's although I'm not involved in that, it's just great to see that
what they've done
with it. So anyway... That was that. So I was about to tell you about
Auntie Jack.
The Auntie Jack. So
we want to hear about Auntie Jack.
A friend of mine was, I can't remember how I first met Rory O'Donoghue, who was Thin Arthur in the Auntie Jack show. But he had a band, he wanted to start a band, and I was asked, how do we get a PA system together? And somehow I'd come across some Voice of the Theatre, Altec A7s, you know, the famous Altec A7. So I got a pair of those, and we used them for the band.
Yeah.
And I made a mixer for them and the whole thing. And we did tours with Supertramp and stuff like that back in the day.
But, okay.
Yeah, but not with my A7.
No. You were using their PA, but the support act. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Oh, hang on, no, sorry, that was Sleeping Dogs. That was a different band. That was Doug Ashdown.
Oh my God, Doug.
So anyway, with Rory though, but.
Yeah.
What we did, we were blowing up the horns quite often because we were quite loud.
Yeah.
And the Voice of the Theatres just have a passive crossover. I think it was two-pole, 12 dB per octave, something like that. And the good thing about them was that it was very easy to change the diaphragm because – They were designed for theatres. So occasionally if you blew them up, the technician had to run down behind the stage, change the diaphragm. Yeah. They only cost, you know, $50 or something to put in a new one, and you could do it in 2 minutes.
It's interesting, though. It's interesting, an observation of how things have changed, that they would be concerned about changing diaphragms mid-film, whereas now... Someone told me a story this morning. About the... maybe it was Brad, but that they were in a cinema. It didn't sound right. Oh, no, that was the out of phase thing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And one of the speakers had been out of phase for, maybe a month or two. We must sort that out. I mean, you just imagine where a diaphragm would blow now and no one would really care. But anyhow, these were designed to be simply popped apart, pop a new one in, and away you go. Done deal.
Yeah. And then, so...
For the sake of customer service and maintaining fidelity...
Yeah, I doubt that they would have changed them in the middle of a movie.
Okay, but either way,
I don't think they were that fragile. But for us, they were, because we ran them too loud, and
using them perhaps in a way they weren't intended to be.
Exactly. Yes. And this must, when I think back, this must have been the early 70s, because I used the little 100-watt amplifier we did as the ETI project.
Yep, yep.
So I had a couple of the 100-watt. Amp modules.
Yeah.
And
it just flashed into my head. ETI 480. I swear that was the part number of the kit. There was a series of those.
There's other things
you've had to remember in recent years, but that just
There
was one particular kit they just sold it for like 20 years.
It was a good little.
You had a bunch of those. Amp. Yeah, they were 2 and 3 and 5. That was all it was.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I had some of these lying around, and I just made a 24 dB per octave crossover. So 4-pole, high pass, low pass. And I can't remember who suggested to me to make them active, and I'd stop blowing up the thing. So I did that, and I mounted. So effectively I had a separate amp for the horn now and a separate amp for the 15-inch bass driver. And we put the little 24 dB per octave crossover in front of it. Mm-hmm. And it just completely, it was miraculous, the improvement.
Okay.
It was just so much cleaner.
Well, yeah.
Much cleaner. We could go louder. We never blew another diaphragm up, because now they had twice the protection, rolling off twice as fast. And...
And rolling off probably more consistently as well, because it was active and not obviously dependent upon the impedance of the whatever the impedence was doing in the drive.
Another issue.
So the sound quality improvement, though, was the thing that actually grabbed you first.
Yeah, that's right. And it was just cleaner. That was the bottom line. It was more dynamic, and that was using, you know, really pretty basic parts.
Yeah.
And so then I just assumed everything was going to go active. I just had that assumption. Yeah. No one's noticed this yet, but it's about to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've made this discovery.
And the whole world's going to go active.
Yeah. I mean, you've heard this enormous improvement, one could assume, in the same way, although this was before Fairlight, but the point is it was chalk and cheese.
Yeah.
It was dramatically better.
Yeah.
The cost of the amplifier module was... bugger all for a second one, really.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't everyone do this?
Yeah.
Well, actually, of course, in Pro Audio,
they kind of did.
Yeah.
But of course, they couldn't, because the whole marketing of audio and hi-fi meant it would have been way too complicated.
Yeah.
Because you just needed a speaker box to be able to be wired up to an amplifier with two wires. A
piece of lamp cord,
And that was why, to this day, that's why hi-fi is not really HD audio. It hasn't happened yet. So the...
well...
But it's about to... I mean is it hasn't happened affordably, right?
No.
It's getting there, but it's very hard. I mean, yes, you got speakers that can do it, and they're reasonably affordable, and I was just saying to Brad, as good as Brad's speakers are, the Mu2s, for example, by definition, they've got crossover distortion between their tweeter and woofer,
mm-hmm.
because they're not perfectly time aligned. They can't be.
No.
The baffle is determining the fact that the same sound, the same frequency is coming out of the tweeter as is coming out of the woofer, at least over that crossover zone, which let's say is about an octave wide or mm-hmm. something. So yeah, it's subtle. It's a subtle reduction in resolution, but it's definitely there. It's a sort of a, it's a flanging. It doesn't sound like flanging.
No, no.
But it's it is
phase disturbance.
It's a phase distortion.
Yeah. So
and DSP's an active.
Yeah.
You know, lets me now Wilson Audio, to give the example, they physically put their tweeter back.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they have the tilt, so the tweeter goes back. I think the mid goes back slightly as well.
Yeah.
And that will improve the time alignment mm-hmm. between the drivers. But doing it in the analog domain is verging on impossible,
mm.
you know. Not to mention the compromises you make with the passive crossover filter designs. You know, you're losing, yeah. as you say, you've got impedance changes
yeah, yeah.
dealing with that you're dealing with. If you're able to just take the output of an amp, connect it directly to the winding on a speaker, you've got nothing in between. Mm. You've got real grip
yeah, yeah.
from the amp to the diaphragm
yeah.
for every driver. So now you've got a lot of options because now you're doing all your crossover designs in front of the amplifier at preamp levels.
Yeah.
No, you're not having to handle yeah. 100 or 200 watts, you know.
No. So what I'd like to... absolutely, and it's a great subject, and it, as I said, the pro audio world has embraced it because the pro audio world is about performance and function and reliability and getting a job done and producing great sound in the process.
Yeah,
hi-fi is a bit more mystical, a bit more magical.
It is.
So I want to break this episode here, yeah. and we'll. Tell the deck story in episode 2. That's what I want to do.
Sure.
So thank you, Kim. Thank you, Brad, by the way. I hope that camera's not running. And
thank you, Andrew. And thank you, Kim.
Dodgy-looking recording arrangement here, and we'll be back. Well, we're going to start recording episode 2 right now, but you'll hear it next week. Thanks, everybody.
Right.
Thank you.
Are you a vinyl lover looking for your next great find? Wax Lyrical is the record club for music enthusiasts, delivering hand-picked albums every month. We don't just send records, we give you the full experience, complete with exclusive listening notes and a community of like-minded music fans. Whether it's a hidden gem or a classic masterpiece, you'll discover something new to love. Join Wax Lyrical today and keep the music spinning. Hit Wax, that's with a double X, lyrical.com for more information.